Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, April 9th, 2024, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Well, this week is the 15th anniversary of the birth of Starseed Hotline in 2009, and in this episode, you'll hear the intricate story of the energies that aligned with galactic orchestration to create the vehicle for empowering star seeds to better serve the planet. In the past 15 years, we've helped many thousands of star seeds to step into their missions, better understand their gifts, and fulfill their promise to assist the Earth and her people through this global shift that has been ongoing. Even now, star seeds are still waking up across the planet and searching for understanding, and Lavendar's light information is empowering them with higher truth. We have much of that information in our Vault of Knowledge on our website, which is starseedhotline.com/vault.htm to get right to it. Tonight, Lavendar and I tell the story of how our paths converged, ultimately leading to the birth of Starseed Hotline in 2009, and then this radio show a year later in 2010. This story demonstrates that even when you don't know the destination, there are unseen hands with a plan guiding you to it. At the top of the show, it's Anastasia's Starseed News, bringing topics of interest to starseeds that you won't hear in the mainstream. If you are an astrologer and are ready to learn advanced starseed astrology, please send me an email, ariel@starseedhotline.com. Lavendar and I are gathering a small group of qualified people to learn the starseed codes. Excuse me. Our main website is starseedhotline.com. The Stage 1 Starseed Confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your astrological chart, and the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one Zoom session. We also have a new daily transit service to help you navigate your life and mission with greater success, even if you know little or nothing about astrology. And remember, if you have a birthday coming up, you're going to get a window of 10 hours of power. And because of leap year, it may happen before the day before your birthday. So you can find out exactly when it happens by requesting your solar return timing. If you can order that a week or two before your birthday, that's enough time. But if you want a reading of that chart, order it about 2 months before your birthday. So first up tonight, I would like to introduce Anastasia with her fascinating Starseed News.
Oh, thank you so much, Ariel. You know, from listening to the applause week after week, it sounds like we might have the same audience every week. I'm beginning to recognize some of those screams.
And they still love you.
That's great. I'm glad they never get tired of me. I never get tired of them. All right. We've got some fun news tonight. Hang on. Let's get started. I have an interesting story about books. I'm telling you bibliophiles out there to rejoice. If you're interested in books, it should be an interesting story for you. Sotheby's Book Week. Now, we're talking Sotheby's here. We're talking about a very pricey auction house is having a book week. So it isn't quite like a library sale. But this year is going to be led by an extraordinary collection of modern literature. The auction house is offering up the library of a surgeon who quietly amassed a selection of some of the most notable books released in the 19th and 20th centuries. This includes titles by Charles Dickens, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Edgar Allan Poe, and Arthur Conan Doyle. Leading the auction is an autographed manuscript of the Sherlock Holmes novel, The Sign of Four, which is set to become the most valuable Doyle item ever to come to auction. With an estimate of up to $1.2 million, the book is signed twice by Doyle, and it shows some of his edits as he worked to Americanize the text for the United States. Now, what is fascinating about this is they have a picture of it on the net, and it's in handwritten script with an ink and quill pen. Fascinating to remember that long before we had word processors, typewriters are a long thing of the past, but before we had machines that would print out for us our copy, it was all done by hand, handwritten. Amazing. If I were a millionaire, multimillionaire, that would be quite the thing to collect. Anyway, if you're into books, which I am, I think it's pretty cool stuff. And speaking of books, speaking of rare books, check this out. A rare 400-year-old book titled Un Discurso del Chocolate, A Discussion of Chocolate in English, is regarded as the oldest known book solely dedicated to chocolate. It also is coming to the auction block in Portugal. Portuguese are prized for their chocolate, by the way. Well, this artifact was printed in Seville in 1624 and is one of just three surviving copies of this work. It was written by a Spanish doctor and an academic. Until now, only two other copies of the work are known to exist, one housed in the National Library in Madrid and the other one at the University of San Diego in California. The starting price, oh, peep chocolate lovers, is a mere $2,170 for this little 1624 chocolate book. Does that tempt you, anybody? There you go. $2,000 starting price. We'll be interested to see what it actually ends up selling for. A book about chocolate from 1624. Sometimes we forget that the world in the past was, they weren't all stupid back then. They knew lots of stuff. And somebody wrote a book about chocolate way back then. Well, this is somewhat concerning. I suppose even more concerning if you're a criminal, but I find it concerning just for general purposes. If a criminal wears gloves, their cast-off DNA can still be present in a room's air. A study has suggested that if such material gets sucked up by an air conditioner, it could let investigators know if a suspect has or hasn't been in a certain room, according to scientists from Australia's Flinders University. So now they can tell what room you've been in. Wow, that's wild. Now, Tennessee has made history by signing the, it's called the Elvis Act, by the way, and that's an acronym for, the title of the legislation is, Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security Act. Now, they had to really work to put those two words, all those five words together, however many they are. They wanted to come up with Elvis. So, Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security Act, the Elvis Act, is now the first piece of legislation specially designed to protect artists from unlawful mimicry by artificial intelligence. The Tennessee governor emphasized the significance of this act, saying, Tennessee is the musical capital of the world, and we're leading the nation with historic protections for Tennessee artists and songwriters against emerging AI technology. Under the Elvis Act, individuals will be barred from using artificial intelligence to imitate an artist's voice without their prior agreement, which I think is outstanding and probably should be done worldwide.
Well, yeah.
Sooner rather than later, like as in yesterday or last week.
Right.
Well, it's time now, it's that time of year for the Happiest Countries in the World report. We talk about that every year. I'm here to bring you the story. It's in its 2024 edition, and there's been some changes in the top 10. Now, general happiness is, of course, a tricky metric to accurately measure. But the World Happiness Report does so by assigning a score to each country that they have polled using data gathered on individuals' life evaluation. Those polled are asked to fill out a survey giving scores of their lives on a scale of 0 to 10, naturally 0 being the worst and 10 being the best. And of the nations polled, unsurprisingly, Afghanistan, once again, has been decided to be the unhappiest country in the world with a score of 1.721. The unhappiest country in the world, Afghanistan. The United Kingdom, meanwhile, ranks as the 20th happiest country with a score of 6.749, and the U.S. is 23rd, behind the U.K., with a score of 6.725. But of that, what countries are the happiest? And here they are, the top 10. I'm going to give them to you in reverse order. Number 10, Australia is the 10th happiest country in the world, according to this happiness report, with a score of 7.057. Now, last year, that position was held by New Zealand, which has now dropped down into 11th place. So Australia has moved ahead of New Zealand, and it is 10. Switzerland is number 9. And 2 years ago, this country was ranked 4th. There have been some changes. Luxembourg is the 8th happiest country in the world. It ought to be. It's very wealthy, extremely wealthy. Rich people live there. The 8th happiest country in the world with a record of 7.122. Norway is number 7 with a score of 7.3. The Netherlands, a score of 7.319, is number 6. Surprisingly, and this makes me question the whole study, Israel is number 5 with a score of 7.344. Now, given the war in that country and the politics, which are profoundly upset, Israel is a surprise. But they tell us, according to this study, that it's been in the top 10 since 2 years ago. So, I don't know. We'll see. Makes me wonder. Number 4 is Sweden. No surprise. Its World Happiness Report is 7.395. And Iceland is number 3. Denmark came in at number 2. It's been dubbed the second happiest country in the world. Now we're down to number 1. Who has the top spot for the happiest country in the world? It happens to be Finland. And this is the 7th year in a row that Finland has been named the happiest country on earth, achieving an overall score of almost 8, 7.741. There you have it. Finland, happiest people in the world, happiest country in the world. Finland, I want to go there. Sounds like a plan. What would it be like to live in a country where people are really happy? Wouldn't that be delightful? Just think about it. Well, all right, I'm going to call to mind. I'm going to ask you to pay attention now to when you're driving. And if you happen to be behind a US UPS truck, how many have you noticed that they almost never turn left? Just think about it for a minute. Oh, you're going to go, yeah, you know what? Well, it is a fact that here in the States, when we're stuck behind a delivery truck in traffic, we just hope a right turn is coming up, because we sure don't want to wait behind a truck that's trying to turn left, and there's a lot of oncoming cars. That just means a long wait. So according to one of our major newspapers in this country, that over the last 10 years, roughly 90% of all turns made by UPS delivery trucks are to the right. And they tell us that that's on purpose, because there's good reasons for doing so. In the U.S., where motorists drive on the right, making that left turn can be time-consuming as we wait for a break in the flow of traffic in the opposite lane. Now, time is a very critical factor for a delivery company, which has a lot of stops to make, little time to do it, and speedy deliveries make for happy customers. So less time spent waiting in traffic, therefore, adds up to improved efficiency. They tell us that UPS has dedicated software that creates the perfect route for their trucks, and the benefits are not deliveries are arriving on time and people are happy with the service. They say that UPS says, turning right more often than not saves more than 10 million gallons of fuel over 10 years. And perhaps counterintuitively, it results in an average of 6 to 8 miles less driving distance on delivery routes. In addition to avoiding 100,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide pollution over 10 years, turning right, this is what they say, saves carbon dioxide. It actually means that they're helping the planet. It saves gas and it saves carbon dioxide emissions, and therefore it's better for the planet. So there you go. That's why they're turning right all the time. Now you know the inside story about UPS drivers and trucks. Who would have thought of it, though? But you'll notice, you're all going to notice, when you're behind one of those, which I am often, living in a location where they're everywhere, they do turn right. They really will. They'll go around the block, and I've observed that. They'll turn right and go around the block and come back to back up instead of going left. That's what they'll do. All right, well, that's too much information about nothing. Let's talk about whales. The indigenous leaders of New Zealand, Tahiti, and the Cook Islands have now signed an historic treaty that recognized whales as legal person in a move that conservationists are calling a tremendous breakthrough. They believe that this will apply pressure to national governments to provide greater protections for the large mammals. Whales have needed protection for a long time. Mm. An Indian conservationist said, it's fitting that the traditional guardians are initiating this, the First Nations peoples. He said, for us, restoring these world populations of whales is also restoring our own communities. The connection between animal and person, between whale pods and tribes, it's not lost on them. So in defending the whales and protecting them, they're also protecting their own tribes. And it's a beautiful thing. So, wow. Now, the Biden administration has also restored threatened species protections in the United States, the ones that Trump dropped. Among the changes, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will reinstate a decades-old regulation that mandates blanket protections for animals and plants newly classified as threatened. That means that officials won't have to craft any specific plans to shield each individual species while protections are pending. They're just automatically protected. Tremendous. I remember when that got dropped, I was concerned about that, and so were so many others, but now it's back into place. A broken thing has been fixed, and it's very good.
Yeah.
Well, there's a story about happier chickens. I don't know about you, but I want my chickens to be happy. According to the latest statistics from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, more than 40% of hens used for eggs in the United States are now cage-free. Really? And 11 states have banned the practice of caging hens. Isn't that something? Just
wow.
15 years ago, that number was only 3%. So when we started Starseed News, it was about 3% of the chickens were free. Now we are at 40% in 15 years. That's the changes that have occurred. They say that free range is absolutely the only humane way to farm chickens. We say that, this is progress. It's not perfect, but according to the Humane Society, this is big progress. We're making it. We're making some headway. Well, let's talk about news consumption. I'm in this business with you. I'm giving you the news tonight. Well, a new study in Nature has just put some numbers on what is arguably the most important rule in journalism, except over here. In journalism in general, the saying is, if it bleeds, it leads. So why are most headlines filled with gloom? Because news headlines containing negative language are more likely to be clicked on than those containing positive words. Specifically, for a headline of average length, each additional negative word increases the click-through rate by 2.3%. By contrast, for each positive word in a headline of average length, the click-through rate decreases by 1%. Given that click-through rates are generally in single digits, these percentage differences are actually enormous. Which leads us to wonder, what is it about negative things that are so magnetic to human beings? And when we really think about it, moment of editorializing here, in our own lives, as we've done a reconstruction on ourselves and on our beliefs and thoughts, how difficult sometimes it is to pluck out those negative inclinations because they've been buried so deep. And we have to work at it. And it would be wonderful, really, if others would know about it and work on it too. But people are trying. It's getting better. But people are naturally drawn to negativity. That's just been just a fact. News sells, that kind of news. Well, we just had a change in time zones. I'm always sort of messed up by that. I think many of us are.
Yeah.
I have a few facts for you that I'll bet you don't know about. So we'll just say that this marks our springing forward this spring. Let's talk about some oddities. Now, time is generally based on GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, also known as UTC or Coordinated Universal Time. Well, the biggest country in one time zone is China. China keeps things simple. It might have an area of nearly 4 million square miles, but ask each of its 1.4 billion residents for the time, and you're going to get the same answer. It's GMT plus 8. The same is true of India. The whole country, which observes GMT plus 5 and a half. Yeah, that's right. Some countries do halves, 5.30. An entire country, the same time zone. Now, Russia is the world's largest country by area. It covers 11 consecutive time zones. And by the way, the U.S. also uses 11. That really surprises me. I never think about it. I deal mostly with the mainland and sometimes Hawaii. So, you know, that's what I know. But there's 5 on the North American mainland, and the rest is made up of island territories. So we do have 11 time zones in the United States. Now, I can tell you how to gain an entire day. The international dateline roughly follows the 180-degree line of longitude, which splits the Pacific in two. You want two birthdays in a row? You can celebrate in Samoa at GMT plus 13. Next morning, take a 30-mile flight to a neighboring American Samoa. That's GMT minus 11. And 25 minutes later, after you've crossed the international dateline, you'll land on your birthday again. And if you want to skip Christmas, you can just travel in the other direction. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
So, on the South Pole, either the North or South Pole has an official time zone. I didn't know that until just now. But those scientists need to set their watches to something. So in the North Pole, research stations follow the times in their respective countries. But the U.S.-run Admonson Scott South Pole Station uses New Zealand time. So go figure, and the International Space Station follows Great Britain's time, Greenwich Mean Time. They're geared towards Britain, and they say it's because, well, they navigate the whole entire globe, so why not Britain? So, you know, look, what time is it? And that seems like such a basic, simple question, doesn't it? But there are so many ways to answer it, depending on where you happen to be. I wanted to share this with you. This is something that I found. It's a 72-year-old man was asked what he might share with the rest of the world. What has he learned in his 72 years? And he gave a list of things. I'm going to share this with you. Number one, it's usually better to be nice than right. Number two, nothing worthwhile comes easy. Number three, work on a passion project, even just 30 minutes a day. It compounds. Here's one for some of you out there. Did you know that working from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. isn't productivity? It's guilt. Number five, to be really successful, become useful. Like houses in need of repair, problems usually don't fix themselves.
Right.
Don't hold on to your idea until it's too late. And people aren't thinking about you as much as you think they are. He tells you to write your life plan with a pencil that has an eraser. And never say, I'll never. He wants you to know that not all advice is created equal, and invites you to be the first one to smile. He says that the expense of something special is forgotten quickly. The experience lasts a lifetime. Do it. Just do it. He says that who you become is more important than what you accomplish. And that nobody gets to their deathbed and says, I'm sorry for trying so many things. He tells you there's always going to be obstacles in your life, especially if you go after big things. Isn't that the truth?
Oh, yeah.
Try to spend 12 minutes a day in quiet reflection, meditation, or prayer. Try new things. If it doesn't work out, stop. At least you tried. Don't say something to yourself that you wouldn't say to someone else. If you think you have it tough, look around. So, wow, that's an entire book. That's a volume of wisdom that we could all benefit from.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty wise for a 72-year-old, actually. Well, the unidentified flying objects have caused so much concern in recent years that even NASA has launched a lengthy probe to find out what they were and are. Now, some experts believe that the hunt should move from the skies to the sea. The former head of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, is launching a probe into unidentified submersible objects called USOs, and in particular, a strange anomaly seen off the sea, on the seabed off the coast of California. Sonar has revealed an unusual trench on the seafloor as if an object has crashed into a ridge and then skidded to a halt. Wow.
Wow.
So it's not just UFOs anymore, it's USOs. In Aruba, this Caribbean island of Aruba, beautiful place, has drafted a constitutional amendment that would make it the second country in the world after Ecuador to recognize that nature has inherent rights. The amendment also affirms that people are entitled to a, quote, clean, healthy, and sustainable environment, end quote. Beautiful.
Yes.
And if you like cinnamon, listen to this. Did you know that cinnamon is a hair loss treatment? So they say. A component of the aromatic spice cinnamon has caused hair follicles to sprout in the lab. Researchers are now set on developing a novel treatment to reverse hair loss through the use of natural compounds. Hair restoration treatments are limited to either surgical, like hair transplant, or drugs. So finding this treatment is exciting scientists at a national university in Japan. They say that they have made hair grow with cinnamon in the laboratory. So I'm going to be watching. Let's see what happens with that.
Yeah.
And cinnamon. Cinnamon's actually really pretty good for us for lots of reasons.
Yeah, I love it.
I want to share one last. You know, we got summer's coming. Time to plan on your vacation. I have some suggestions for you. How about going to stay at one of the royal properties in Great Britain? How about going to stay in one of the cabins that are owned by King Charles and Queen Camilla? Are you up for that? You can. Now you can get an up-close and personal look into the lives of the King and Queen at Balmoral Castle. This is a Scottish holiday residence of the British royals, and it's going to open its doors to the public for private tours this summer. It's the first time it's been open to the public since the castle was completed in 1855. In a new promotion dubbed the Balmoral Experience, guests will be taken on a guided tour through rooms in the castle used by the royals from the 1st of July to the 4th of August. You can learn about the history and use of the spaces along the way. You can get a tour of the Aberdeenshire Castle. It's only about $126. You could also add on an afternoon tea. And actually, they also have available Buckingham Palace, which they're going to open to the public. But that's not all. These estates, and I think there's about 10 of them, these royal estates have cottages on these massive properties, and they're renting those out during the summer for up to 1 to 2 weeks at a time. And they have actually, I've checked it out, they have space. Some of them are booked, but as you move into the summer, there's openings. So if you would like to go stay at a royal cottage, and they are outfitted accordingly. A little rustic perhaps for the royals, but not rustic by most people's standards. Really incredible spaces with the beautiful royal estate and the gardens and, oh my goodness, the ponds and the beautiful livestock. Good grief. You can see the castle in the distance and little cottages sprinkled everywhere, and you can rent those for your summer vacation if you want to. So you can check that out. I think there's a website called Country Cottages, or you could type into Google, rent a royal cottage in the UK. And you could do that for your summertime experience if you wanted to. Because, you know, I'm going to leave you with a quote. You didn't come this far to only come this far. I think that applies to Starseed Hotline, to all you Starseed out there, to each one of us. We didn't come this far to only come this far.
That's
there
a good one.
A lot more to do. Yeah, a lot more to do. Much joy ahead. Much beautiful expression to offer. And speaking of that, from my heart to each one of you, much love, everyone. I'm really proud of you, Ariel and Lavendar, for bringing the world to Starseed Hotline, the forum, bringing starseeds together. Wow. Helping to people to find their purpose in themselves and the greater meaning in their lives and the companionship and association of like-minded people. Oh, my gosh. It has really been so helpful to so many, just a lifesaver for so many. So thank you for what you've done, and thank you for allowing me to share it with you. I'm proud to be with you all, and I love you very much.
We love you, too. And, yeah, and it's an honor to be doing this work and to know that it does make a difference.
I can tell you that it does. Starseed I've talked to that have worked with you and Lavendar have been deeply thankful and really made a difference. It's a love thing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Lavendar's life work, which started before most of us were even awake, and it's just been a privilege to present this information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's absolutely right. All right. Well, I'll be quiet so you can carry on. We've got a good show tonight.
All right. Well, thank
you
so much.
Catch you guys next time. Yes, dear.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Okay, so on with the story of the birth of Starseed Hotline. Right, I'm going to get your mic open, Lavendar. And I'm so excited to tell this story because, you know, we've told it at the Quests, but we've never really explained or told the story of how all this got started. So I'm kind of going to ask you a few questions just to get it, get the ball rolling. So you've told the story many, many times of how you went to Cairo and on Pleiadian lineup in 1983 at the instruction and request of your Pleiadian team. And you did that, and you took the little tiny Giza crystals that came from a mine in Arkansas. And you took those crystals into the Great Pyramid where they were charged. And I'm just giving you the thumbnail version of this because we've told this story many times on the radio. So when you came out of the pyramid on November 19th, did you come right back to the United States, or did you travel some more over there?
No, I actually went to Israel and I was told to go plant some Gizas in the Valley of Armageddon, which I did, and then I then flew to Switzerland and stayed there for about a week. Just to cool out and, you know, get a new sense of direction because so much happened to me in the pyramid when the Pleiadians came. I, you know, it was like a huge adjustment to come back to Earth and say, okay, this is what I have now. And then when we left Switzerland, we came to Greece. And I spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 days on the island of Crete. And then suddenly I was reminded that I had to immediately change our plans and fly back to the United States. And that's when I realized that a lot of walk-ins had happened over Pleiadian lineup. That's where a lot of celebrity walk-ins I'm talking about, that you could actually check and see how many of them were placed in the hospital. There was a lot of exchange beings from the Pleiades. A lot of Pleiadians went home, and a lot of them came back to the planet. So after that, I took these crystals, and at that time, we didn't have the internet. We didn't even have the fax machine yet. So when people found out about these crystals, they wanted to have some. They wanted to place them. I was told that these Gizas were coated with energies not of this world, 7 million times celestial power. And when I said, well, how strong is that? They said, we have nothing on the planet to measure them with. So they went to lakes and mountains and trees and people, and they just kind of had a mind all of their own. They're really tiny in their structure, but they're so powerful in their energetics. So a lot of people started contacting me wanting these crystals, and lo and behold, all of a sudden Australia became a major point for people to go and plant the crystals around Ayers Rock. And all these years, I've wondered why so many people were led there. I mean, you have to, you know, get an airplane for long rides. I mean, it's a really taskmaster to get to the Ayers Rock. Well, years later, I found out that symbol on top of Ayers Rock was the same symbol they found recently in the last few years in a pyramid in Giza in Egypt. And it meant time travel. So I thought, oh, maybe they're going to make the rock do something crazy or aport it, or I don't know. I've been waiting to know about Ayers Rock. But anyway, I started, you know, handing out the crystals to people that wanted them. And then in 1991, I guess, I was in Georgia, and I had decided that that was time for me to, I had a lightning experience where I really had come to terms with, I'd been hit, you know, 3 times by lightning, and I was getting to the point where I was really getting tired of being tested with lightning. So I was at a friend's house, and she said, you know, there's a little cabin down the road, and you can go down there and have a session with this person. And first of all, I didn't want to have a session with this person. I was in a state of mind there where I thought, you know what, I just need to walk away from this work for a while. But this person kept insisting, said, oh, no, you've just got to do my solar return. I hear that you do really fabulous work with your birthday readings. And so I agreed. And when we got down there, it was a screened-in porch. And as I was talking, lightning started striking, and it first struck, you know, one side, and when it started happening, I thought, you know, it's time for me to embrace lightning and not be afraid of it. And I really took full power that day. And after I took it, the lightning hit on 4, 2 in front of me and 2 behind me, and every time it happened, I would just breathe, and it was like I was gaining strength and energy from the lightning. Well, after this happened, I said, now what? It was like, oh, boy, what have I done now? So I got in my car. I heard, well, you need to go to Florida, and you need to find the eagles. And I said, what eagles? Well, you'll know. You will know. And I had a Lincoln and an American Express. And so I just took off and went to Florida. And so now you go ahead with the rest of the story.
Okay, well, at some point after you came back from Egypt, you went through Arkansas.
Yes.
And you left some crystals.
Yes, my hand crystals that I used in Cairo were given to me by Garland Milhellen. And when I got back from the initiations and everything, I came back to Arkansas, and I went to his shop, and it was called the Monte Cristo, and I said, you know, I've got a feeling that someone's going to come here one day, and you're going to know who to give these Gizas to, and I had them in a little envelope, and I did that, I guess, back in 19, let me think, I guess it was in 83 when I got back, So I had handed them to Garland in 83, and then when I got the instructions to go to Florida to find the eagles, I didn't really have it in my mind I had not even remembered that I had actually given them to Garland. I had to be reminded of it later. So now you can go ahead with your story.
So while you were doing, you know, high planetary work in the Great Pyramid, in the Pleiadians, and the walk-in demonstrations, and all of that, while you were doing that, I was living in Florida, and from 83, when you were there, until, you know, like 8 years later, I was singing, trying to work on a CD and, you know, get the record deal, and but I just was going from one gig to the next gig, and I felt like I was just like, what am I doing? This, I can't just continue to do this. So I felt like I was a little bit lost, even though, you know, I had work to go do. I just had no idea where I was going with all of that. So in 1987, I was singing in Key West, Florida. And I'd been there for about a year. And one night, I was in this big hotel where I was performing, and this guy came in, nice-looking guy, and on my break he came up to me, and he noticed I was wearing a crystal necklace. He came up and said, "Do you believe in crystal energy?" And I thought, well, that's a line I haven't heard before. And I mean, and I was intrigued, and you know, we started seeing each other, and it turned out that he only came down there for, you know, like weekend vacations. He lived in Jupiter, Florida, and in order to be closer to him, I left Key West and I moved to Jupiter, Florida, and was doing the same thing, you know, singing here and there, and in 86 that I moved to Jupiter, and then in 1987 I actually married the guy. It only lasted about 6 months, but when it was like, from my honeymoon, I want to go to Arkansas and dig for crystals, and he was okay with that. So in 87 I went to Arkansas, and we went digging at all the places that we, you know, have been going with our groups. And he wanted a big crystal. To him, size was everything. And we were driving down the road, and we just saw this old building with a side yard and a whole bunch of tables. And this one table was really, really long, like, you know, like a huge, long, you know, table. And on that table were 16 giant crystals. I mean, some of them were 4 feet long, and we're talking about single terminated crystals. Some of them were like 4 feet long. They looked like torpedoes sitting on this table, and they were, you know, all different sizes, but they were huge. You know, we turned out that the guy that owned the place was Garland Milholland, your friend. Of course, I had no idea about you or any of that at the time. And, you know, and he said, you're welcome to look and be with the crystals, but they're not for sale. So it's like, well, you know, he really wants a big one, so do you have any friends that are in the business that might have a large crystal? And he said, well, I'll have to look around, and we'll come back tomorrow. So, well, I guess an important part of the story, while we were there that day, we were chatting and kind of bonding, because apparently I physically resembled his daughter, who had just died from cancer, and he was still, you know, grieving. And when he told me that, I was moved and inspired. I sang him the Lord's Prayer, just standing there in the shop. I mean, there was only us. And I sang him the Lord's Prayer, and he started crying. And it was a very touching and bonding kind of moment. So I said, well, we'll come back tomorrow. And when we went back to see if he'd located some large crystals, he said, well, I've given this some thought, and there will be no negotiation. You can go out on that table and pick any one of those crystals, and it's going to cost you $100. Now, I mean, even that long ago, those crystals were worth $5,000-$10,000 apiece because they were so huge. But he, you know, there had to be an exchange. So we go out and we're walking up and down this table looking at these crystals, and I had my eye on the smallest one because it was the only one that didn't have the tip broken off. And if a crystal doesn't have the point on the end, it doesn't work. It can't focus energy. And if they're really cloudy and milky, they don't work either. They've got to have that clear. And there was only one of them, and it was the smallest one. And I was standing there with my hand on it, and I looked over at Garland, and his eyes were twinkling. This man had the thickest white, I mean, snow white hair, and eyes that were so blue, you could almost not even look in them. You know, so sometimes people's eyes are almost transparently blue. And I looked at him, and I thought, this is definitely the crystal god right here. But I looked over at him, and his eyes were twinkling, and I had my hand on the little one, and I was like, I really like this one. And he smiled, and he said, that's the purest one. And that is the one that came home with me. And he also gave me a huge piece of amethyst. It was an amethyst geode. Looks like an amphitheater. I mean, it's just really big. And another huge cluster of crystals. But I was thanking him, and, you know, we gave him the money. And just as we were about to leave, he had already, I'm saying he because I really don't even want him to say his name. He had already gone out to the car, and I'm standing there alone with Garland. And he said, come over here. And he took me behind the counter, and he said, I was given this by a friend of mine, and she told me that someday someone would walk in here and I would know that these were for her or him. And he handed me this little kind of tiny, tiny manila envelope thing, just about the size to put a house key in. And on the outside was written, Lavendar, Cairo, 1983. And he opened it up and he poured some of these teeny, tiny crystals into his hand. I'd never seen anything like it. They were tiny, perfectly clear, double-terminated, about the size of a grain of rice, or smaller. And he said, these are for you. And I didn't know what to do with them. I was honored, and I was thankful, but I had no idea what he had just given me. So I took them home, and in 1987, and I put them in the top drawer of my dresser because something inside of me said, these are so special that if you don't know what to do with them, don't do anything. Just leave them be. So they sat there for another 4 years. So here, this is the 8 years where I'm just kind of wandering aimlessly, going from job to job, not really having any kind of a plan for the future. And I was still living in Jupiter, Florida. So one night I was at that time singing at the Jupiter Beach Hilton, and I had a friend who was a chiropractor, and she used to come and see me all the time. And this one night she came in, and she had a friend of hers who was in town at the time and introduced me. And we started talking on my break. And this lady, her name was Susan, she was kind of going on and on about, oh, and just the way she was talking, I still remember. She's like, oh, you've got to meet this star maiden. She's in town. And you just, she's so fantastic. You've just got to meet her. And I'm thinking, what the hell is a star maiden? I didn't know. And I thought, well, yeah, that sounds nice. And I kind of forgot about it. And then she said it again. And she said, well, you know, I do tarot readings. You know, why don't you come over to my hotel tomorrow and I'll do a reading for you. And I thought, well, okay, that sounds fine to me. So I went over and sitting at the table with her, and she was, you know, doing the cards and talking. And she said it again. She said, you have just got to meet this Star Maiden. She's in town, and you'll never meet anybody like Lavendar. And at that point, my heart just about flew out my mouth, because that was the name on the envelope that had been sitting in my top drawer for 4 years that Garland had for 4 years before that. And it's like, all right, this was a moment in time that I'm never going to forget. And I mean, I couldn't get home fast enough. She had given me the hotel where you were staying, your phone number, the room you were in, and I called you up, and I said, well, you don't know me, but we have a mutual friend, and his name is Garland Milholland. And like it was yesterday, I remember your exact words. You said, do you realize what you're saying? I thought, well, yeah, I think I do. I had no clue what I was saying. I had no clue of the implications of that. So you asked how to get to my house, and you were there in 30 minutes. And I had just happened to have had my chart done, and I remember handing you the chart, and you'd look at the chart, and then you'd look at me, and then you'd look down at the chart, and then you'd look at me. And I felt like you had X-ray vision, like you were looking right through me. And we went to that Chinese restaurant. Remember, we were there for about 4 hours. And you just started downloading all this information about the Pleiades, about extraterrestrials, about the starseeds. And even though, I mean, I had only found out about crystals a couple of years, you know, 2 or 3 years before that, I knew I was hearing truth. I just knew it. And at that time, I was living on this little farm in Jupiter. I was living in the downstairs apartment, and there were some other people living in the upstairs apartment. And that girl had been in an accident. Her name was Heather, and car accident, and she'd broken her arm really bad. And she was in a lot of pain, going back and forth to the hospital, and just laying on that couch, which was pretty much right above my bedroom. Taking pain pills all day. Well, you came to you know, my house in Jupiter, and you showed me what to do with the little geeses. And you said you put them in a little tiny triangle, and it opens this standing column or wave, and it's like a portal. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty cool. So I did it right away, and I put these, you know, right by my bedside table. And after about a week, the girl upstairs, who was on the couch right over my bed, she went to the hospital, and they thought they were going to have to put pins in her arm. And it's like, this is amazing. It just started to heal. And her arm healed up so quickly, she didn't need the pins. And the corn plant, there was a corn plant right by the couch that flowered. I've never seen a corn plant flower. But the energy of the geeses were so strong. It healed her and, you know, flowered the corn plant. And then she says, like, you know what, we're going to move back to New Hampshire. So she goes back to New Hampshire, and the upstairs apartment was empty. So that's when you moved in. And we had our adventures. That was in 91. And you told me, well, why don't you just tell what did George Van Tassel tell you about waiting? And you've said this on the show before, but this is a part of the story. When you talked to George Van Tassel in 1977.
Yes, when I took a walk with George out into the desert, and I didn't realize at that time what was actually happening to me. I had to look back later and go, oh, my goodness, that's what that was. We walked out into the desert, and he would reach over and touch my forehead, and then he would start downloading information. He told me about technologies that were coming to the planet, walk-ins, the Tesla kids, the Tesla technology that would be bringing free energy to the planet. He was talking to me about his Integraton and the information that was given to him to build it, just all kinds of things. And remember, in 1977, I mean, nobody was talking about walk-ins. I mean, Ruth Montgomery had just maybe had written a book, but I don't even think it had come out yet. I don't think her book came out until 1980. So there was not any mention. So I didn't understand when he was talking about walk-ins what that really was. So about 3 hours of this, he says to me, well, it's time for you to go back to the house. And he pointed to the rock, giant rock, and he said, I want you to know that when that rock cracks, that's when it's time for you to release your information. Safety of information, he said, that I was carrying at that time. So I went back to the house, and everybody was having dinner, and I said, well, George will be in a little bit. And I went into a bedroom and laid down because I was so blown away with what he was sharing with me. I just had to go be by myself. And so I laid down and went to sleep, and I woke up about 10:30 or 11 and heard all this racket in the living room, and they were all upset because George wasn't back, and they were putting together a team to go look for him, and this went on for, I don't know how long, maybe till 1 or 2 in the morning. I don't remember the exact time. And then all of a sudden, George just came, and he just walked in the door. And he goes over, and he touches everybody on in their third eye, and then he sits down. And what I realize now is he erased the very fact that he'd been gone or something. I'm not sure what he did with all the people that he did that to, but he didn't do it with me. He wanted me to see what was transpiring. And what had happened was when he walked out into the desert, they came and got him and brought a walk-in. So I got to observe and experience what it was like to be in the presence of a new walk-in. About a month later, he and Doris, his wife, were over in California at a motel, and he had a heart attack and died. And Doris called me immediately. I was in Santa Monica that day, and she knew it because we kept close touch with each other all the time. And she called me, and she says, you've got to come quickly. George is dead. So when I got there, she showed me the table and the lamp. The table had been split in half, like lightning had struck it, and the lamp was crushed. Everything in the room was rearranged, and she was hysterical. And I said, oh, my goodness, what has happened here? Well, it took a little while to figure this out because I had realized that I was being put in a position to take charge of his funeral and everything that happened, and I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, he's just downloaded all this information to me, and now he's gone, and I don't even know who to talk to about it. And remember, it was 1977. So about, I can't remember when it was, but it was probably after the funeral, Doris came to me, and she said, I need to tell you something. I said, what? She said, that wasn't George. I said, what do you mean? She said, when he came back from that walk with you, he was different. And I had to know, I had to keep it to myself because I thought, oh, my goodness, something really happened out there in the desert, and I don't know who to talk or tell about it. And she said, I'm telling you now that was not the same George that left with you. Another George came back, and he was totally different. So I said, oh, my goodness. So that was, he gave me the demonstration of a walk-in. So then years later when the rock actually cracked, and I think that you had an experience with a man that had been there and that knew Doris at that time, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So now we just fast-forwarded 10 years from 91 to 2001, and it was February of... it was February of 2000 or 2001. Now I can't remember, but it was one or the other. I had met someone who knew Doris and George and had been to Giant Rock, and I had called you to say, because you're not going to believe this, you know, I meet someone in Atlanta who's connected to this whole story, And it was right about, I think it was 2001, that the rock split, just like George said.
Yeah.
And you knew then that it was time to release your information. But even then, the internet wasn't anything like it is today, and we weren't really sure how to go about doing that. So, you were a little, you've been holding it for so long that when it's like, okay, you can let it go now. You couldn't, you know, just like it had been secured away for so long that, I mean, you had trouble making the decision to go kind of public with it.
Yeah, and so, also I'd like to add that on that walk with George, he told me that I would be in training with ETs for 25 years and that I was to take my high strangeness experiences and I was to write them down and put them in a bank vault, and I wasn't to release them until after the crack happened with the rock. And so when the rock cracked, I mean, I just went, it was almost like I felt it in my soul the day that it happened. And I have written about that in another article. But I thought it was very unusual that this man came to you after he'd just been to Giant Rock. And so there was another connection that was happening. Yeah. And you and I had already moved to Georgia by that time.
Right, yeah. We moved up from Jupiter in early 92. So we moved up to, you know, to Georgia. And then it was, I mean, you were taking care of your parents at that time. So that wasn't the time to launch. And it was in 2008, really, when, you know, I started thinking that, you know, we could do a website, and we were talking to Anastasia at that time, and, you know, I put together the website, and kind of like the rest is history. But what has happened since then, in the very beginning, so we launched in 2009, the website, and then the radio show in 2010. So, I mean, we were doing, you know, readings, and at that time, when we first started off, you were still doing the stage one readings.
Right.
And then it became apparent that really your forte is, well, you got to be talking to the person to get that third file in your brain that opens up. You've got to have that voice print. So you quit doing the stage ones. However, in that time, that very short period of time when you were doing the stage one, you know, recordings where the person doesn't actually talk to you, you had done a recording for a lady named Claire, and Claire had a friend named Tammy. And Claire said to Tammy, if you want to, you know, well, how did she say it? This will be the best $25 you ever spent, because when we first started, that's what it was. And we have since evolved from, you know, given 20 minutes to given 40, 50 minutes. But at that time, so Tammy got a reading from you, and that was, you know, enter Tammy. So very early on. And then in 2012, we went to France with Kathleen McGowan on the Mary Magdalene quest, I think we called it. And Tammy was in on that. She came to France. And I have to say, Tammy, I am still so proud of you, because you had never been on an airplane and your first trip was overseas. That took so much courage, and you showed up. And I remember we were at this place called Magdalene's Grotto, and that's where something really wonderful and otherworldly was activated, and Tammy's healing work just went up to like 4 or 5 levels at the same time. But that's where when we got back from France, Tammy wanted to do, it's like, let's get a reunion for all the people that went to France and take them to Arkansas and go dig crystals. So it was Tammy who came up with the idea for what has now become the Starseed Quest. And it was the Crystal Quest at first, and then it's much more now about than just about crystals. So over the time in 2012, 6 months later, we had our first Crystal Quest, and it was, you know, it was all Tammy. She came up with the idea, and she had she stayed vigilant. And now, you know, the whole three sister spin, it's you and me and Tammy. So all of this happened, and think of all the people that we've had that have come to Arkansas. And I remember when Tammy was kind of formulating this idea, we were looking online, you know, trying to see some places, some venues, and Tammy says, "Well, you know what? I'll take a hit for the team. I'll drive to Arkansas and go check this out." And she really, really wanted to go. So that's just a sense of humor there. But so when Tammy got to Arkansas, I mean, she called me up and she said, "This is surreal. Everywhere I go, people want to be by me. They want to stand by her. They want to come and talk to me. They rolled out the red carpet," and she, it took years for her to figure out what that was all about. But it was like, you know, Tammy returned home. And by 2013, she had moved there. And now, you know, Tammy lives at the center point of the crystal grid on sacred land. And I just wanted to say that there have been so many wonderful people that have come together at the quest, that have claimed their power, that have gone on to do wonderful things all over the world. We have people coming from all over. And none of that would have happened without Tammy getting that idea about taking people to Arkansas, and now it's evolved so much that and it just keeps getting better and better and stronger and stronger. So
I'm sitting in Tammy's house now on top of a crystal grid, and I have been here since April, have not been back to Oklahoma after the passing of Richard. So I love it here, and I'm trying to figure out ways to move here, because this is the land, and the land speaks to everyone, I think, that comes here. You know, the land is so inspirational. It's beautiful. We have lakes and trees and these beautiful crystal mounds that are here, but that it's more than that. It's like people that come here somehow, the you know, quartz is an amplifier, and it amplifies people's personalities, it amplifies their records, it makes their blood crystals pop. And so when they come here, they have, you know, quite an experience just from the land alone. Even if we didn't have them, you know, doing certain things on certain days, even if they just came and hung out here, I think it would still happen. It wouldn't happen like what we do, but I'm just saying that the land is calling people to come home. And there's a homing device that seems to be happening in this crystal vein here. And I have the feeling that a lot of old Atlanteans will be showing up here sooner or later, and different pockets of karma will be taking place from this land. So I'm very thrilled to see so many people that have returned. We have alumni that come back time and time again. We're having another alumni this November, And we put out the calling, and within 48 hours, we were already filled. So to see the people coming back time and time again, that really tells you something. It's like there's something that they get each time they come, and it's like an upgrade, I think. That's the way I look at it. I saw one gal that came, and she was very quiet, and she was very demure and very scared. Now she's taken her power. Now, we can hardly recognize that quiet one anymore. We can't shut her up. The joke that we have with her.
We've had a lot, you know.
Yeah, people just change, yeah, for the better.
Yeah, and when they come back, it's really apparent that they have really stepped up. And it's amazing to me how people that feel the call to a particular gathering, the other people that feel that call too, they've got soul records together. They recognize each other.
Go
ahead.
Let me just interject something here that I think is really important, because I've come to know that the kids that were born after 1980, there's the ones with star markings, they have some kind of resonant field in their system that when they hear a code or hear something, it puts them on alert. Like, I started asking people, I'd say, well, how did you find me? And they go, oh, I had a dream about the word starseed, and I got up and Googled and found you. The first two or three times I heard that, I thought, well, that's cute, that's quaint. After number 30, I went, wow. Went to the ship, and I said, what are you guys doing with that word starseed? And they said, well, don't you remember? That's the one code word that all of you agreed upon to find one another, because technology was going to be up on the planet where you could find one another. And I went, wow, that's true. Okay. And it keeps happening, and it keeps happening, and it keeps happening, and it's just kind of gone over the top. So with that being said, the people that do come to the quest, they have to have these star markings, or they're not invited. So when they walk through the door, a lot of them think, oh, I'm going to go in. First thing I'm going to do is see Lavender when I hit that door. No, when they hit the door, they start seeing their soul family. I'm probably the last person they get to say hello. That's how extreme it is when they hit that door. And it's a calling. If it's not a calling, they can't walk through the door. We've had people even buy airplane tickets and get to the airport, and they couldn't get on a plane to come because they couldn't walk through the door. All kinds of things have happened that let us know that this is an extreme ET or starseed calling, because the people that get to walk through the door were meant to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've talked about the orchestration. And, you know, Tammy and I are the ones that organize the quest. And then, you know, you kind of walk in with the meat and the filet mignon, and we take care of all the side dishes, you know, and organizing and taking emails. And, so between Tammy and I, we get to see that every quest, there's 10, maybe 20 people who say, oh, yeah, I'm coming, save me a spot. And then something happens, and they can't make it. And it's not that there was anything wrong with those people. It's just that they weren't part of this particular tapestry. It's like, no, we're working with these records right now, and only people. So it's not only about the star markings, which are really all that we have access to, but from aboard ship, they're moving people like pieces on a chessboard. And it's like, no, you come at a different time. You got to come this time. And they move people around, and that's how come when they walk in, they recognize each other. And there's so much, harmony. But, yeah, there are people who they think they're coming, and they really, really want to, but it's not their turn. And that happens every single time, you know, and even to the point where, you know, Tammy and I, it's like, okay, you know, maybe they'll make it this time. And then, lo and behold, there'll be a quest when they show up, and that was the one that they were intended to come to. And then, of course, once you've come once, it's a lot easier to come the second time, because you'll be bringing the codes from whatever group you were with to the current group. But yeah, and you know, I mean, Tammy does so much in organizing, in paying attention to details, making sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. So, you know,
She's also introduced her new feather work that she does at these quests. The last two or three quests that we've had, we have introduced the feather work that Tammy does, which is so incredible, that activates so many people with their Native American records. The times that we've seen her do her work, I mean, there's just a calm in the room, and yet everybody's eyes are big and watching, and the things that people are seeing that happen in the center of the room, it's pretty awesome, pretty awesome. It's hard to describe on radio.
Yeah, yeah, and Tammy does a very big, moving, impactful presentation that is... The information is so sacred that I didn't even want to, you know, give a topic. Excuse me, but it's the true history of what has really happened on that land, and she keeps getting downloaded with more and more information. But that is only for our private time at the quest. But
right.
it's momentous. Momentous, not only in clearing records, but in returning to joy.
How many quests have we done now? I forgot the number.
We've got the 28th coming up.
8, okay.
28.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And in August we had, it was our 27th quest, and we had 27 people show up.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And then in May, we had 33 people, and 11 of them were alumni. So I look at the patterns and the numbers of it, but it's like this was not a plan, a human plan. You know, we just field the emails and handle the 3D logistics of it, but most of it's out of our hands.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, and we have a wonderful team that helps us at the quest. You know, Denise, Jada, Sheila. And then we have other people that come and go. They're not there every single time, but, you know, Caitlin, Mari, wonderful Starseeds, Riley, that have all participated in support, because we can't run that whole event with just the three of us. So the help of those star seeds is immeasurable. And then we have another team helping us with the radio show. You know, Fiona, Jada, Kathy. In the past, we've had Vanya and Claudia. We love all of you and so appreciate what you do. We just have star seeds all over the world, and it all started with you going to Cairo in 1983.
Yeah,
taking those geese and giving them to Garland. When you stand back and you look at it in retrospect, you can say this was so divinely planned. But when you're right in it, you don't see that. You know,
well, that's
you just
the way I was when Giant Rock cracked. It's like, oh my goodness, this has really happened. He told me this would happen, and it's happened. And now what am I going to do? It's like, And by this time, I've already gone through 25 years of high strangeness to the point of almost insanity. So it's like, okay. The rock is cracked now, and I'm not sure if I want to take it out of the vault. You know, you had to coach me a long time before I ever brought it out of the vault, if you remember that.
Yeah, well, you needed a double Aries to light that fire under you.
Yeah, that's true.
And now, I mean, there are so many people. I mean, literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And they're all, I mean, they're star seeds. And then for those people, if they each touch one person or they awaken another star seed, it's spreading. And it's global. It's not just here in the United States. I mean, it's everywhere. And when you think about the people that we've met that come from, you know, from England, from Germany, from Ireland, from Italy, Norway.
Australia. Yeah.
New Zealand. And we've had people from Indonesia and India, Germany.
Vietnam,
France. You know, it's just, it's amazing to step back and look at how this is spreading. And the reason that we wanted to tell this story is because there are lots of star seeds out there who are actually on a defined track to, you know, the success of their mission and getting it out there. But very often, you're unaware of that. You might think you're lost or that you don't, you know, have anything to any direction, or and your team is upstairs just kind of laughing. It's like, oh, she thinks she's lost. But they have a plan, and they just nudge here and there. So the key is just to keep your ears open. And when you get a nudge, when you get a feeling, when you get something that starts pulling at you, don't submerge it, because it's, you know, that's how this internal guidance works. You know, excuse me. And for me, it's like, okay, they had to throw a man into the mix. That'll get her out of Key West. Sure enough, it did. You know, and he just happened to live in Jupiter, where you were going to be.
Find the Eagles. I had to find the Eagles.
Yeah.
Jupiter. Yeah.
5 years in the future, that's where you were going to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, in retrospect, it's real clear. But when you're right in it, it's not clear at all. And you feel maybe lost. So the point is, even if you think that you don't have a direction or you don't know where you're going, you're already on your path. And, you know, just like the movie Castaway, you never know what the tide's going to bring in. So keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, and know that you're not alone, and you have powerful friends in high places who are helping to direct you to where you said you wanted to go in this lifetime.
One of the things I'd like to add is that each one of the quests that we've had, we send the Gizas with the people, and they go and plan them or give them, or because the Gizas kind of have a mind all of their own, and they let you know where they want to go. And so I'm putting together a map of where all the Gizas have been placed, and they were actually turned on, I think, last November, or November before that. I can't remember. It was in the last couple of years. Anyway, on Pleiadian lineup. So I know they're beeping, and if we could look from space, I think we'd see a crop circle of some kind. There's a pattern of where these geeses have been placed. I just really feel strongly about that. So, and we don't have many of them left, so we're not promoting this to get people to carry geeses, because that's in fact, you can't go on the website and really order them without having a session with us or coming to the quest. I want to make that very clear.
Yeah, there's just a finite number of them left. So that when they're gone, they're gone, I guess.
Yeah,
but
that's
right. A cool thing about the Gizas is that they will program other crystals.
Yes.
So you could, if you could come up with the solution crystals, which they are because they form in water, they're tiny little hair-like double terminated. If you can find a source of those, and you get the original geeses from Egypt, then you can turn the others into geese's. They
jumpstart them. You can jumpstart them. Yeah.
That's what I was looking for. They will program other crystals with their energy, but the geese themselves, they don't absorb energy.
They're not like other ordinary.
They're not like other crystals. They don't hold emotions or anything like that. They are a balancing beam between man and nature, and Lord knows we need one.
Yeah,
every time we listen to Anastasia's news, you know, I mean, and when she's talking about all the flooding, I mean, I kept wondering that if Noah was going to float by pretty soon, because I mean, we've just had floods all over the world. So
And how about the fires? Fires and water are happening. Fires and water. The fires of Amazon. Fires in California.
Yeah. Well, you know, people that think that our habits have not affected the weather system, you might want to think again.
Think again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that is our show for tonight, and I want to thank you all for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks, and until then, you take care and hold compassion in your heart and relinquish judgment. Until next time, good night, everyone.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.